But we've lingered rather a long time over all that, so it's time we came to the third and concluding part of the lecture. And this concerns Eastern and Western attitudes towards the Guru. It's very difficult to generalize, and we must be brief, we don't have very much time. But I think we can say that in the East, the Guru, sometimes at least, tends to be overvalued. And in the West, usually undervalued. Now what do we mean by overvaluing the Guru? In a sense, the Guru cannot be overvalued. I mean, nothing can be more valuable than the person who helps you to evolve, to develop. But when I say that the Guru in the East is sometimes overvalued, I mean that a false value is attached to him in a very exaggerated sort of way. For instance, in India, people sometimes say the Guru is God. God, the all-powerful. In fact, they say he's all the gods rolled into one, not just as a figure of speech, but quite literally. When you're sitting in front of the Guru, you're sitting in front of God. There's God sitting there on the floor, on a cushion. Not just a human being, it's God. So being God, he knows everything. He's sitting there looking just like an ordinary human being, but he knows everything that's going on in the whole universe. And he knows everything that's going on in your mind. He can read all your thoughts. He can see exactly what is happening. If you're sitting there and thinking of home, he knows it. If you're sitting there and thinking of him, he knows it. If you've got a problem, he knows it. You don't have to tell him. He reads all your thoughts just like an open book. Not only that, but he can do anything he likes. Being God, he's all-powerful too. He can do anything he likes for the disciple. He can bless him, can give him riches, can make him famous, can get him promotion in his job, can give him children if he wants, if his wife is barren, just a blessing, just a word. Can do anything he likes, rescue him in time of trouble, in danger. He can even give him enlightenment if he wants to. It's all in the Guru's hand. It's all the grace of the Guru, as they say. So therefore, it's often said that faith in the Guru is of the very greatest importance. Faith that the Guru is God, that he's just like this, he can do all these things. And if the disciple only has faith enough, the Guru can work miracles on his behalf. But of course there are little difficulties. It sometimes happens that the Guru appears not to know something. He appears to be ignorant of something. And sometimes he even appears to forget something that you've told him. It's as though you hadn't told him. So you may get a bit upset by this. But the true disciple isn't upset, because he knows that all this not knowing and this forgetting, it's all a test. See, the Guru's only pretending. He wants to test your faith. So he doesn't really not know, he's only pretending to know, so that he can see whether you believe him still or not. He doesn't really forget anything. He's testing you, just like tapping a pot after it's been baked with the finger, just to see whether there's a crack in it or not. So in this sort of way, over the weeks, over the months, over the years, the disciple comes to inhabit a whole fantasy world. A world in which the Guru is all-powerful, and whatever happens is happening on account of the Guru's grace and the Guru's will and the Guru's wishes. And if the Guru isn't careful, he may come to inhabit this fantasy world too. Especially if he isn't a real Guru. After all, it isn't easy sometimes to escape. If someone comes and tells you that his child was sick but has recovered due to your blessing, well, even though you haven't even thought about the child or knew anything about the child, if you're told that the child has recovered due to your blessing, well, you may not be inclined to dispute that. You may just sort of accept it and say, well, I suppose it's so. Now, obviously, not all disciples go to this sort of extreme. Some see quite clearly after a while that the Guru isn't really God. They begin to see that he's a human being. He does have his limitations. He can't do everything. He's got a certain amount of insight and experience, sure, but he can't read your thoughts, not all of them anyway. So what do such disciples do? They conclude that he isn't a true Guru. So they go and look for somebody else. They go off to look for someone who is a true guru, and the same thing happens all over again. Huh? When they first meet him, they think, oh, here's the real guru, he's God. Huh? Then they start noticing these little discrepancies, so they get disillusioned, think he's only a human being, all right, go and look for somebody else. And this sort of process can go on for quite a long time. Huh? I remember a Tibetan friend of mine, a very famous Tibetan Lama and guru, talking to me about his own experiences and saying that he remembered that when he first came to Kalimpong, which was the town where we were staying, everybody flocked to him. Huh? All the Tibetan Buddhists, that is to say, Nepalese Buddhists, because there was no other great Lama there at all at that time. They all flocked to him, and they brought him wonderful offerings and took initiations, and they sang his praises. But he was there 5-6 years, and in the end, they got a bit tired of him, he said, and he was very amused by this. And he said he used to come, yes, but they didn't bring quite as big offerings as before. And then a new Lama came, a new guru, who actually was a friend of the first one. And when he came, everybody else went off to the new one and left the old one high and dry. Huh? And they were both rather amused by this. Huh? And then sooner or later, as the Chinese communists started taking over in Tibet, more and more gurus came. And the poor lay Buddhists, they got very bewildered, not knowing sort of what to do, which one to go. They couldn't get there quick enough. Huh? As soon as a great new guru arrived, and you'd hear, oh, such and such guru has come, you know? He's the greatest in this or the greatest in that. We haven't seen anybody like him. And they will rush off to see him and make their offerings. And then before they sort of really got over this excitement, another one was coming. Huh? So they sort of quickly get together another lot of offerings, and off they'd rush to this one. He was the real one. And they must have gone in this way to about 19 or 20 gurus until one day, well, the Dalai Panch and Lamas, they both came, and then they just didn't know what to do at all. Huh? So this is the sort of thing that happens. Huh? One might even say that this sort of thing can happen even in the West. Huh? You get someone coming from the East, and all people think he's marvellous, until the next person comes from the East, and they switch over to him. And in this way it goes on. Hmm? All right, now let's come to the West. Huh? Let's try and understand why the guru, huh? Or rather, before we do that, let's try to understand why the guru is overvalued in this way, in the East. I think it's very clear what is happening. The guru is being regarded in cases of this sort as a sort of father substitute. Regarded as being all-knowing, all-powerful, infinitely loving and tolerant. In other words, a parental figure. And the disciple in such cases will adopt an attitude of infantile dependence. Now I must say that I've personally encountered numerous examples of this sort of thing. In India, gurus are often very popular, but there's usually one demand that is made of them. One thing they must be or do, regardless of anything else. They don't mind whether you teach this or teach that. That's quite irrelevant. They don't care whether you wear a yellow robe or a white one or a yellow one or a red one or a black one. That, again, doesn't matter. There's one thing that the guru must always be, so far as popular belief is concerned. He must always be very, very kind and affectionate and soft-spoken and gentle and so on. In other words, a sort of parental figure. This above all.